Welcome back to BadQuaker.com. With me today is Stefan Molyneux, a legendary figure in the... Well, I don't have to tell you. If you're listening to me, you know who Stefan Molyneux is. I'm Ben Stone. We are at Porkfest 2012, the New Hampshire Liberty Porcupine Festival, and we're all having a blast. Stefan, thank you very much for coming on the show with me. I know my listeners will appreciate hearing you.
Well, thanks, Ben. I must say this is my first outdoor interview. So
yeah.
As I get less coherent, it's simply because my blood is being drained away by mosquitoes.
Yeah, there
well,
was
sorry,
a...
even less coherent. So as my thought process dissolves later, everybody will know it's just because of these little vampire bastards that keep eating me, because I don't know, foreign flesh is their best food.
Pure blood.
Pure blood.
They're after pure anarchist blood.
Canadians and Americans, so yeah.
Well, you see, the more moral you are, the more pure your blood is.
Any
form of ancient religion will teach you that.
That's right.
I think it would kind of be redundant if I were to sit here and talk about anarchy with Stefan Molyneux to my audience. You probably aren't familiar with what I do and everything like that, but essentially I am the opposite side of the coin from you. You're famous, I'm not. You are...
famous, you know, that's... here, yes.
You're an atheist?
Yes.
I am a theist. On the other hand, everything that I... every concept that I want to present to my audience, I attempt to present it in a logical fashion so that it can be easily accepted to a theist or any type of theist or an atheist, because my theory is that if it's true logic, if it's true, and if it follows a logical pattern, then it should ring true no matter what your theism or lack thereof is. And if we all seek the truth and set aside anything else, then whatever the truth is, if the truth is atheism or the truth is something else, if we're seeking the truth, eventually, hopefully, humans will find that. So
yeah.
That's kind of where I'm coming from. But,
yeah, I think that you have to... It's the Socratic argument. It's also a Churchill's argument, which basically says you just have to follow reason and evidence.
Right.
That has to be the flag you sail by, it has to be the wind you sail by, it has to be the stars that guide you. And that can lead you to some uncomfortable places, as I'm sure it has with me and with you as well, and with everybody who will ever listen to this. But if you're going to go down the path, then you have to go down the righteous path. To me, I mean, if you're not going to go down the path, then, you know, join the herd, join the collective. I don't really think there's anything hugely wrong with that. That's a fine choice for me. But for those of us who want to pursue truth, you got to have something to guide you, and it's got to be more than history, culture, you know, all of the nonsense that passes for thought
right.
These days. And you've just got to keep lashing yourself to the mast and going through the storms. I think that's, you know, otherwise, you know, stay on the beach.
Yeah. Now, considering everything that I just said there, and we do have a lot of background noise as cars go by and speakers and dogs are going to bark.
It's ambience.
And, yeah.
You can almost smell the mesquite.
Yeah. Now, let's go in a direction that people that I've heard don't normally take you. Your name is Molyneux. And great-great-grandfather, great-great-great-great-uncle?
Well, if you wanted the origin of the name.
Well, I was thinking of, wasn't there someone who was possibly executed or banned or something or other
I think it was John Molyneux. I actually came across his name when I was studying psychology as an undergraduate at York University. He was a great friend of the British philosopher John Locke. They were best friends, and they were persecuted for their skepticism towards religiosity and the aristocracy. And I actually read a biography of him, which was truly weird when you think about it, because he was saying to John Locke, he said that the major This is my ancestor. The major goal of philosophy must be to define a system of ethics that is independent of governments and gods.
Mm-hmm.
And I only read this years after I had worked on a system of ethics that was independent of governments and gods. So it was just one of these little goosebumpy coincidence moments where you wonder how much is in the blood and how much is in the environment. And I just thought that was really quite fascinating.
That is wild. I have a theory, and someone told me one time that that Mises contradicts this. And my response was, Mises was wrong. My theory is that there are certain animals that are born with certain things already hardwired into the brain. When a butterfly transforms into a butterfly from its previous state, if it's a monarch, it's down deep in the jungles of Mexico, and when the season turns, it knows that it's supposed to fly to Canada.
Yeah.
It's a stinking butterfly, and it knows how to get to Canada from Mexico.
Right.
Nobody taught it that. There was no mother, there was no, you know, well, there's a mother, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's certainly not something that is transmitted. Like, fly right with me, they don't even know who their kids are.
Exactly.
Like immunity.
So you can't argue that it's learned behavior.
Right.
And I think if a butterfly can do that, if a squirrel instinctively hides nuts, then there are certain things hardwired into humans. Now, we may go through a lot of processes to wash that out or to beat that down, but deep within the human are those essential things that allowed us for eons of time to get to where we are now. And if we consider the state is only about 9 to 12,000 years old, at very best, and that's going by archaeology, if the state is only 9 to 12,000 years old, that's a blink. That is nothing on an evolutionary scale. So then, we have hardwired within us what it takes to survive.
Mm.
And I believe that things like what you're talking about there, that desire for certain things like truth, drove us to resist. And even if we talk about myths or religions or whatever, these are still a tiny wink in the human experience. They haven't been around that long. There's things like the... I think they were Neanderthals, and it's politically correct, incorrect to pronounce it that way, but I'm old, so.
There's a politically correct lobby for Neanderthals.
Yeah. You're supposed
to. We prefer to think of ourselves as pre-cavemen. Thank you very much.
But there are, they put flowers on their dead. So there's a possibility that myths existed at that time, or maybe not. Maybe they were just missing someone and flowers are pretty,
or maybe they were just
hiding
want to cover
smell.
Up the smell. Yeah,
exactly.
That's why this Eastern food is so spiced, because
yeah,
it was so often not very good, right?
True. Thank you very much.
Sorry, have I sparked some conflict with the listener here?
No, she's just a fan of Indian food.
No, I love Indian food, too. I mean, it kicks my ass regularly because I'm a whitey boy, right? So it is like getting a horse's hoof of spice directly to the head. But it was because it's so hot, right? They have to, mm-hmm, you know, oh, this meat's a little gamey. Let's spice it up a little. You know?
But if we accept that as evidence of some type of a religion or myth or whatever, then we still have only had myths and religion and so forth, as far as evidence goes, that we can talk about with any certainty, for a very small wink in time. So the desire to seek truth can be hardwired deep within a human, like that butterfly situation.
No, I think it is. I think everything that is essential about us drives us towards truth, and that is what must be opposed by propaganda, by misinformation, by, you know, whatever you want to call it. Everything that, I mean, I've been a stay-at-home dad now for 3.5 years. My daughter's drive towards universalization is nonstop.
Mm.
You know, is that, she was saying, this is a chair. Is that also a chair? Yes. Is that also a chair? No, that's an ottoman. What's the difference? You know, her desire to universalize, which is really the essence of language. We can't have language without concepts, and can't have concepts without universalization. Everything that is within her and within you and I is the drive towards universalizing things. So, you know, when we're playing catch, she doesn't expect the next ball to just go up,
right,
and keep going. She's trying to universalize at all times.
Mm-hmm.
The next butterfly is not going to suddenly turn and try and bite her eyeball out.
Right.
So the drive towards universalization, which really is the philosophical pursuit of truth, is elemental and essential. We can't survive in the world unless we universalize. And so we're allowed to universalize in the physical world because that makes us productive to our owners.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not allowed to universalize in the moral realm.
right.
the non-aggression principle as a universalization, because if we universalize in the moral realm, we can't have rulers. But if we universalize in the physical realm, we're very productive cotton pickers and slaves and producers. And yeah. this is true even if you're some lawyer paying taxes.
Yeah.
And so I think that we instinctively have the drive towards universal truth, we have the drive towards universal ethics, we have the drives towards universal concepts, and we are propagandized to create this opposite realm called power, called the state, called the hierarchy, where the moral rules are completely reversed, and we're not even allowed to know that they're reversed. So, you know, some guy sticks you up with a knife in the ribs in an alley, he's stealing from you.
Right.
Some IRS agent comes by and, you know, he's enforcing a valid social contract.
Yeah.
I mean, these make no sense whatsoever. And not only are they completely contradictory, but in the true Orwellian doublethink, we're actually not even allowed to notice that they're contradictory. And anyone who points out that these things are the same is insane.
Yeah, they
Whereas
become the bad
true insanity is everyone who not only observes these, but doesn't even process that they're contradictions. So I think we're in agreement there.
Right, exactly. And so what do you say to that? I mean...
Well, what do you think of the God gene, both of you?
Well, I think that there's no question that there's a universality of mystical experience among people. I think that there seems to be a universality of death experiences for people, that the body releases massive amounts of endorphins and other opiates to
DMT.
Yeah, all of this kind of stuff. There is a form of brain seizure or epilepsy that can regularly produce religious visions, to my knowledge. And so I think that brain issues can cause this kind of stuff. I also think that if you create significant enough trauma in children, and I think throughout most of human history that's pretty much been a given for children, you will create a drive or desire to dream of a better world, to dream of a world where all the wrongs are righted and all of the evil is punished. And it's what Nietzsche called the slave morality, which is, I'm a slave, I can't stop being a slave because they've got all the guns and the legionnaires and the swords and the knives and the state and so on. And so I'm going to make a virtue out of being a slave.
Yeah.
Right? So to be humble is to be good, to obey the secular rulers is a virtue. So because you can't escape your slavery, you make a virtue out of it. But the problem is that creates a huge amount of rage deep down.
Yeah.
Right? And so where do you put your rage? Well, you put your rage in the fantasy of an afterlife where these rat bastards who control and own you are going to burn in hell forever.
Yeah. And so, you finally have your reward.
God is going to take my damn vengeance and stick it down these guys' throats with a satanic pick.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's a lot of emotionality that drives that kind of stuff, which is perfectly, perfectly understandable. And I'm not trying to put all religious or mystical experiences in that category, but I think that explains a fairly significant portion of it.
Right. This is my co-host, Kai, by the way.
Oh, and sorry. Is this your mic? Is this your spit on the mic? You were doing a really passionate show last night. Okay, good.
She and I talk quite regularly about the hero, and we have dogs entertaining us at the moment. She and I talk regularly about the hero god worship and that as a necessity for the state, and they feed off of each other. You see in archaeology, you see the hero god appearing in archaeology at the same time as the state, and in every locality where the state pops up, the hero god myth pops up with it.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, maybe it's a coincidence, but maybe it's a coincidence when you walk outside and you're getting all wet. Maybe it's not really rain. Maybe it's a coincidence, but the odds are it's rain.
Yeah. Well, the hero god is I think directly analogous to the state.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with heroes is they become so large that we look up to them, and you know, we barely fit the gaze up their nostril hairs. But the problem is, as the hero grows larger, we grow smaller.
Yeah.
And that's what's needed for a hierarchy, right? So there's no such thing as a state. There's just, I mean, you think of the king, right? There's that old Monty Python line, how do you know he's a king? Well, he doesn't have shit all over him. I mean, that's the only way that they knew, is to be carried aloft from the hordes.
Uh-huh.
He's just a guy with a crown. And what do they say about a crown? It's a hat that doesn't even keep the rain out, right? I mean, that's all a crown is. And how do you believe that this is not just a man, well, you need some sort of mysticism. And the mysticism takes two forms, right? The first form is, well, God put him there.
Yeah.
And if you go against this guy, you're going against God.
Mm-hmm.
And so you create this huge, infinite penumbra around the guy that is the puppet master of his every move and can never be questioned, and that's how you elevate him to someone who is fit to rule over you, is you create this massive, giant, imaginary friend mm-hmm. that, who is perfect and omnipotent and runs his every move, and that's why you have to obey him. Now, in the modern secular West, that's a pretty hard notion to believe in. So they substitute something else called the will of the people, called the social contract, called the voting majority, called whatever. Mm-hmm. Whatever crap they have to throw at you to obscure your vision of Barack Obama as a guy, as a king as a guy, as a priest as a guy in a weird tea cozy outfit and a really freaky hat. So they have to create something otherworldly to justify a hierarchy, and then they have to create a hell in order to scare anyone who doesn't believe that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you doubt the divinity of God, you will burn in hell.
Yeah.
And the way that they do it now, though, is very different. It's very interesting. What they do now is, if you don't like the government, you must hate the poor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the hell that they put you into, is social ostracism and criticism.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't like Medicare, you must hate sick people.
Yeah.
You're selfish. It's the same curse, but they just don't put it after.
Or the devil will get you, or you can substitute that for terrorists or...
Anyone who punishes you automatically has a bad argument.
Yeah.
That's, every philosopher knows that. They put Socrates to death because they couldn't answer his arguments. They ostracized Spinoza because they couldn't answer his arguments. So anytime anybody says to me, oh, you don't like the welfare state because you hate the poor, it's like, well, so you can't answer my arguments. Because you're putting some weird gypsy curse on me. You're a bad guy who hates the poor because you can't answer my arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that, if you're into philosophy, you notice very, very quickly, that punishment comes out because we have jails and hell. This is the best we've been able to come up with in 10,000 goddamn years, is how do we deal with bad people? We threaten them with hell and we throw them in a cage.
Yeah.
I mean, how sad is that? I mean, look what our phones can do, right? I mean, our phones can take pictures in panoramic view and talk to satellites and GPSs, and this is what's happened just in 20 years.
Yeah.
But in 10,000 years, what's the best we can do? Threaten people with imaginary fire or throw them in a cage.
Yeah.
And that is because we simply can't answer arguments. And when people are threatened, they ostracize, they attack, they insult. This is what the internet, 90% of the internet runs on this energy, right? This black, dark, satanic energy. Because we just don't know how to answer these arguments, but we're not willing to admit ignorance.
Right.
And so we just lash out. So, sorry, that was a bit of a ramble, but I think
that's great.
That's how people can subject themselves to these hierarchies. It's really tragic.
And I regularly tell my audience that the way to cure this myth is not to go and jump into the middle of the myth and use the myth to beat the myth.
Yeah,
the way to beat the myth is to educate and to set the example with me and my daughter and my daughter and the people I interact with on a daily basis and I care about and I love, with them on a daily basis, as we express anarchism, and as more people do that, and as we just don't think about the state, and completely put the state into what it is. It's a myth, and it's a religion. And when you recognize it as that, and you don't decide, you know what, I'm going to try to use the state to beat the state. So, we only have about a minute and a half, so
you finish my thought. You do not fight a nightmare except by waking up.
Right.
You cannot fight a nightmare with another dream,
mm-hmm.
because that's just surrendering to another delusion. You can only fight a nightmare by waking up. And this is why, for me, political engagement is in many ways worse than useless, other than to maybe educate people a little bit about economics and stuff. But you can only relentlessly turn on and turn up the light. There's nothing. You simply keep speaking the truth. Use as much reason and evidence and passion and humor and metaphor, whatever you can do, to trick and tickle people into accepting a few grains of truth, because the human mind is so beaten up and traumatized by propaganda and superstition that to get it to accept a couple of grains of truth is, you know, like trying to give some monster big pill to somebody, to a two-year-old. They just, you know, it's really hard to do. You gotta really work to get people to listen, but the only answer is to wake up. You know, this idea that you're gonna go in and have some dream combat with a nightmare is just not gonna happen. You just turn the lights on and wake up. And it's a hard thing to do. It's disorienting. It's debilitating for a lot of people. It ejects them from... I mean, the Matrix is our relationships, right? The Matrix is... The world is not the Matrix, because the world is going to do what it's going to do no matter what we do.
Right.
But the Matrix is our relationships, and waking up so often ejects people out of their relationships, at work, you know, people who wake up to philosophy and then people start talking about wars in Iraq or whatever. I mean, it's really hard. It's really hard to live with that kind of truth in a world that is crazy, because we want reason and truth and virtue to make us happy, and it would if we were in a reasonable world.
Yeah.
But we are in an anti-rational world, which means that the more that you wake up, the more people want to put out your eyes, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's really, really hard to wake up in a world that is desperately addicted to sleep.
Yeah.
And nightmares. And so it really does, it is the greatest challenge, is to maintain positive relationships with people who are waking on a different schedule, to put it as nicely as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's worth waiting, I think it's worth being patient, but not forever. And because the truth demands more from us than conformity to other people's illusions. Once you wake up, that's it. And so I hope that helps. I mean, that was a very interesting conversation.
Yeah. Think. Let me steal one more question
please.
From you, and I'll, even though we're past the amount of time I said,
I'm
going to try to steal from you. Realistically, on a large scale, if 10 is civilization-wide anarchy, as we recognize it,
mm-hmm.
where would you grade us? At this point, with one is absolute 1984 totalitarianism, 10 is liberty, true liberty.
You know, it's hard to say, because there's so many scales that need to be brought into bear. I would say immediately we're having this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't fear arrest.
Right.
This is not too bad.
Yeah.
You know, 7, 8, you know, there's still some things you can't talk about. There's a lot of political correct speech. There's hate laws, all of this kind of stuff. So there's some limits, but that's pretty good. So as far as our conversation goes, not bad at all. Certainly one of the better times in history, and the technology has made this unbelievably positive and popular, right? I mean, I got 45 million downloads of my show, and I've never taught in a university a day in my life. So it's made it possible, which is fantastic. But economically, things are pretty catastrophic.
Yeah.
And if you count the unfunded liabilities and debt, economically, it's already fascism.
Mm-hmm.
It's just fascism that has yet to sprout.
Right.
You know, like there's a moment after you take the arsenic, but before you get sick, there's like 3 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we're kind of in that spot. So things, and this is so people who just look for surface symptoms aren't seeing the true picture. They're not
right.
seeing the hole that's opening up under the house, because the house is still standing. And so I think that it's the direction is definitely heading down, but I also think that the ruling classes are very sophisticated, and they're not going to go down with the ship. They're
right.
simply going to turn everyone on the dependent classes. They're going to do what the Russian government did to the poor pensioners when the Russian empire fell, which is they just turfed them out on the street and said, go sell some pencils if you want, but we're not giving you anything for your pension, or we're going to give you something that's worthless. And so, and then we will see the true horror of what statism has done to the poor and the sick and the elderly. And there's no money to pay for Social Security. So what's going to happen? Is the government going to go down with the ship? No, they don't. They want to stay in power.
Right.
So they'll just change the propaganda. It will be, now we are always at war with East Asia. We have always been at war with East Asia. It's time to buckle up. We're going to pull for ourselves. We've got too coddled. It's rugged individualism time. And they'll just turf all these people who've made these bad life decisions based on the existence of statist programs. They're going to turf these guys into the chasm. And it's going to be brutal. And we're going to have to scramble to save people from this sudden yanking out of the carpet from underneath them. I think that's going to be a very tough transition. I don't think we're going to make it to a free society in the next round, but I do think that in a couple of generations, if we work hard and do it right and really try and work with parents to raise their children without aggression, I think that it will become a historical inevitability and a nightmare from which not we, but the planet as a whole can finally wake up from.
Fantastic. Stefan, thank you very, very much for coming on the show with me. You ever get the urge, either here or in the future, we can do it electronically over distance, and I definitely have an open mic for you anytime you want.
I appreciate
that,
Ben.
In case anyone is listening who lives under a rock or anything, if you want to plug your...
Oh, yeah, freedomainradio.com.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, come. The books are all free. The podcasts are all free. Got great subject matter interviews with experts, and I hope that people will check it out and, you know, dig deep into the buffet of philosophy. There's no bill. So I hope people will do it.
And you also have Stefbot on YouTube.
Yeah, actually,
which is very good.
It's now youtube.com/freedomainradio. I actually got the proper URL for it, because this was just some account I created, and then I got grandfathered in with infinite length videos, so I didn't change it. But yeah, it actually has a more reasonable URL now. So.
Okay. Well, again, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
And
thank you so
have
much.
More to do tonight here at Porkfest 2012.
I do. I have to come up with some jokes. I'm supposed to be roasting Chris Lawless, so I got to come up with a few jokes between now and. I thought this would be a good way to distract myself. So good.
Chris Lawless is the giant.
Yeah, the guy who drinks
Ron
a lot.
Ron Paul's giant.
Cake. Yeah, that's all I've got. Ron Paul is the small Russian doll that comes out of him. That's the only thing I got. I'm still working on a few jokes, but right now I have about 3.5 minutes of material, so
I don't know what leprechaun comes out of Ron Paul. It's a Russian doll stacking.
That's right, and at the end of the pot of gold, we have a free society. All right, well, thanks very much, Ben.
Thank you, Steph.